Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, July the 6th, and today we'll be chatting with our friend Frank Burke, author and businessman, and we're going to be talking about the life and times of Lee Iacocca, who passed away this week, a very consequential man in the automobile industry. Certainly, there are two automobiles out there that I think are clearly tied to his efforts, the Mustang from the mid-60s, and then later the minivan, or the van, in the 1980s into 1990s. We'll be talking about that and what made him a successful man and what eventually made Chrysler turn around and just a fascinating man who was born in Pennsylvania of Italian parents. Just an amazing American story. So we'll be getting into that and what did I do? I hit the wrong button here. Let me say hello to our friend Frank Burke. How are you, Frank?
Well, thanks, Silvio. And yourself?
Pretty good. I hit the wrong button there, and I muted myself while I was saying, let me say hello to you. So
it happens the time to me.
It happens to the best of us. You're exactly right. Well, we're going to be talking today about Lee Iacocca. I thought about you immediately when I heard about his life and the passing of Lee this week. But before we get to the Mr. Iacocca and the very famous man that he was, I got to bring up Bill Haley. Bill Haley in the comments. Bill Haley was born on this day in 1925. He died in 1981. But he's responsible for two of the biggest songs in rock history, Rock Around the Clock and See You Later, Alligator, and maybe a few more, Shake, Rattle, and Roll, perhaps. But this was a man who was a bit ahead of his time because he was half a year before Elvis hit the charts. And he was big, Frank. What do you remember of Bill Haley?
Well, I remember basically that Rock Around the Clock was referred to when we were kids as the national anthem of rock and roll. It was like the breakthrough song. And, if you listen to it and you listen to any of Bill Haley's stuff, it has a very defined Dixieland kind of sound. There's a lot of kind of improvisation in it, even in the words. They're not, how can I say, they're not poetic.
they're not.
Much vernacular. And, it's a new sound for the time. Go back to that time. Go back to the pre-rock days, okay? What happened was, and I'm no professor of music, but I do study it. So after the swing era, after World War II, the swing era died quickly. And I've always thought it was because those songs reminded that generation of people they knew that were gone. They were associated with the war, and it was time to get out of that. But there was nowhere to go. I mean, you saw Benny Goodman and some of the others go into things like the Benny Goodman Quartet and the Benny Goodman Sextet, and they were playing really chamber jazz. And in jazz, you had a new movement called bebop. Charlie Parker was an excellent exemplar of that. But other than that, it was how much is that doggy in the window, Patti Page kind of stuff. And then suddenly Bill Haley breaks out.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. wow, it's totally different.
Well,
and
I would recommend.
Were ready for it.
Yeah, I would recommend to the listeners to check out a YouTube video of Bill Haley. There's a couple of them. I guess there was a movie that he was involved in back then.
Yes, there was.
And there's
rock,
a couple
rock,
of scenes.
Rock, I think it was called.
Yeah, there was a movie where he played a He didn't play Bill Haley, but he played someone who was, you know, very much like Bill Haley, a promising
yes.
band, you know, trying to get a contract, that kind of thing. And it's actually a fun movie. It's typical of the movies of that time. There's a lot of dancing and a lot of good stuff in it. And what I was impressed with, Frank, was the number of instruments that he had on those songs. You know, Elvis had a guitar, had a bass, and a drummer. Scotty Moore was Elvis's guitar player, who was also excellent. I was just impressed with the number of guitar instruments. I mean, not guitars, but the number of instruments that he had on the song. And my friend Bruce, who I know will probably listen a little bit later today, sent me a note about a man who was his guitar player. And that's the fellow by the name of Danny Cedrone, who was Haley's guitar player. So I just think there's so many of these connections that we could probably do a whole show on Bill Haley. But here's the fun
Absolutely.
Part. Here's the fun part about Bill Haley. And then we'll get to Lee Iacocca. Try to explain to somebody learning English the refrain, "See you later, alligator, after a while, crocodile."
Right.
Just try to explain that to somebody learning English. See you later, alligator, after a while, crocodile. Just try that.
Exactly.
Try that, and they're going to go, okay, what does that mean? Well, I guess you say goodbye to the alligator and you tell the crocodile. But here's the line. Here's the line. And I did this, by the way. I did this in a class that I was teaching English. I said, okay, how about this one for slang? See you later, alligator, after a while, crocodile. See you later, alligator, after a while, crocodile. Can't you see you're in my way now? Don't you look, you cramp my style.
Yes.
Now that's Donald Trump should give a speech and use that, say that.
I think that would
Congress,
be great.
He should
I think
do,
that would be
see
great.
See you later, alligator, after a while, crocodile. He ought to do
well,
that.
You know,
President Trump ought to do that.
One parenthetical note about Bill Haley and the number of instruments.
Sure.
And that's the fact that, really, Bill Haley was transitioning from the era of the swing band, which was practically an orchestra. I mean, look at the Glenn Miller band, Tommy Dorsey, Artie Shaw. It was lots and lots of instruments. So, really, he was kind of modest with the number of instruments he had.
Well, I tell you, in that video on YouTube of Rock Around the Clock and Shake, Rattle, and Roll, See You Later, Alligator. In those two videos, there's some amazing dancers, young people who were dancing, and just amazing the fun they were having. You could tell they were having fun. Obviously, they're actors, but you could tell they were really having fun with their dancing. Well, let's get to Lee Iacocca.
But
I
just want to say one
more
thing.
Yeah, go ahead,
Silvio, and that's that in recognition of your interest in and expertise on Bill Haley and that era,
Yes. You
are a true Hepcat.
there you go. That's one of the words from that time, right?
It sure is.
Yes, that's one of the words from that time, yes. Well, thank you very much, Frank. I really appreciate that, you know. I really appreciate that. How would you spell that?
H-I-P-C-A-T? H-E-P, Hepcat.
Okay.
And then later on, it was a derivation of hip, H-I-P, which was if you were hip to the jazz, if you were hip to the beat, and then if you were a hep cat. So,
you know, the one good thing that I can say about Bill Haley,
yes,
and this I really value, because I understand he was very ill at the end of his life, because he died in 1981, so he was, 56 when he died, 55?
Yeah.
So he died young for this generation. That's a young age. And I think he was ill for most of the last 5 or 6 years of his life. But he never put Rock Around the Clock to a disco sound. Now, that is something that he never did. Everybody else tried to do disco. Frankie Avalon had Venus on disco. The I Love Lucy theme was put to disco. Everybody was doing disco, and looking back, Bill Haley didn't do it. So I got to give credit to Bill Haley. For whatever reason, he didn't do it.
Musical restraint.
I just don't think Rock Around the Clock would have sounded good on a disco beat. I don't know.
I don't think so either.
I don't think much
sounded good on a disco beat.
Well, I was not a huge fan of disco, but I did like some songs from that era. But in general, I don't have great memories of discotheques in that time frame. I think I was doing something else or listening to different music, I should say, during that time. Well, let's talk about Lee Iacocca, born in Pennsylvania. Lito Anthony was his name, of Italian parents. When did you first come across Lee Iacocca, Frank? When in your career did you first come across this man?
Well, of course, Lee Iacocca received a lot of publicity with the success of the Mustang. And I think one of the things you have to look at with the success of the Mustang, and with anybody who comes up like that, they're really there are a lot of people behind them. For instance, Ford Motor Company was largely blamed. Robert McNamara was blamed for the failure in some ways of the Edsel. And here was Ford, you know, they had produced the Edsel in 1960, I think, 59-60, the Edsel came along, and it was a mammoth failure. And then suddenly, 1964, I believe, was the introduction of the Mustang, and my gosh, it just caught fire. And of course, there are two reasons for both. The main reason for the Edsel was the fact that not only were there mechanical problems, but the research and development had told them from the early 50s, talked about the fact that Americans wanted a larger, more luxurious car. And by the time they had distilled that into the Edsel, people were looking at compact cars, so-called. Then the thing about the Mustang, which was on the boards, you think about how long it takes to create a car. And the Mustang was on the boards for years. But what made it so successful, whether they knew it or not, was the fact that it coincided with the coming of driving age of the baby boomer generation. And not only that, it wasn't a sports car by any means, but people thought of it as a semi-sports car, as a, you know, having a sporty look. And a very unique look, and that's one of the reasons it was so successful. And, of course, Iacocca was there. He was the head man. He got to take the bows. And so I was aware of him then. And then, of course, later on, when Chrysler came almost to fail, he went over to Chrysler and went to the government and said, "You've got to save the company." And shortly thereafter, I was working. That was the early 70s. I was working at Kenyon and Eckhart. And mm-hmm. I had worked on the Lincoln Mercury account, which is Ford related.
Mm-hmm.
And the head of Kenyon and Eckhart was a man named Leo Arthur Kelmanson. And Mr. Kelmanson was a good friend of Lee Iacocca from Ford. And he went to him and said, "Look, if you're going to save Chrysler, you have to be the front man. You have to be the spokesman because people will trust you. You look good. You look regular. You look like a guy who would be at home under the hood of a Chrysler. And when you talk to people, they'll trust you. If we just show pictures of cars, they're going to say, 'Oh, God, no wonder that company's going down the drain.'" And it took a lot of convincing, but finally Iacocca did it, and he was very instrumental in saving the company and, of course, became a folk hero in the process.
Exactly. And but let me go back to the Mustang for a second, because I remember reading his book, and there have been all kinds of wonderful obituaries, of course, about him this last week. The one at The Economist is one that I really enjoyed, because they called Iacocca the King of Detroit, which is a pretty important title for when you consider that there have been pretty big people come out of that city in the car industry. Obviously, Henry Ford being the most famous, others as well. But it's interesting because, as I recall, one of the promotions that Ayakaka ran or put together, you being in advertising may remember this or may have heard about this, was when you buy the Mustang, you put $36 down, $36 a month for 36 months. And that was the, you know, that was the advertising slogan or the pitch.
Uh-huh.
36, 36, 36. Do you remember that, Frank?
That I don't specifically remember.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember one of the kids I graduated high school with getting a Mustang, a 64 Mustang. And, oh, he was just so proud of it. And, you know, it introduced so many things. Bucket seats, the T-shaped shift handle, you know, the shape of the dashboard. Of course, I will say this, the back seat was hellacious. There was no realistic back seat in a Ford Mustang.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But
yeah, that was your classic two people in the front car, and that was it. I don't remember a lot of room, but the Mustang went through a lot of re-editions or additions. I mean, because now you can still get it. You can still buy a Mustang now, but for a while it was not. Was it out of production for a while, Frank? Or
oh yeah,
was
I believe
it just
so.
Not selling?
I believe it was out. Yeah, I think it was out of production for a while. Well, you know, it's like the Thunderbird. A similar thing that then they realized, well, we really had something here. Let's bring it back. And a few years ago, they brought back a restyled but retro-styled Thunderbird.
Oh, wow. Amazing. And what happened between Lee and Henry Ford? I guess this would be Henry Ford II, I believe, Frank, that relationship pretty much ended, didn't it?
Yes. I remember reading that there was a saying at Ford, don't fly too close to Air Force One.
Oh.
And Henry Ford II, I don't think he's been given enough credit for some of the things he did do. One of them was to hire the group of people called the Whiz Kids, which included McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought Ford into the modern age. These were people who, Harold Janine, what they were, basically, he hired the whole Army logistics unit right after the Second World War. And these were the guys, frankly, they had a heck of a lot to do with running the war, with winning the war, because they were, you know, running all the, this has to be here then, and this has to be there now. And so they were geniuses at that. And McNamara and the others were very much into the new age. Computers were just starting, et cetera. When they just started, they picked up on it. But Ford realized that the company was way, way, way caught in the past. That Henry fought the past, you know, and the people around Henry Ford, his security guy, Harry Bennett, were mired in the past and that they were being really killed by GM. So he brought in this group of the Whiz Kids and they turned the company around. But Henry Ford II was a strange guy. He was not personable he was not the kind of guy who could go, you know, on the Tonight Show, let's say.
No, that was not him.
No, that was not him, but
no.
He wanted to, and I've seen that with a number of executives. He was jealous of the kind of people who could, and, you know, you get into any big corporation. I saw it firsthand in industry where the president was really not a good spokesman, but he hired somebody who was, and the Wall Street Journal would call. And they'd say, okay, give us your forecast. And it was always this guy who was the underling who was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And, you know, the guy would get jealous of them. And sooner or later, when the Mustang was attributed to Lee Iacocca, I think Henry Ford got very jealous of that and said, no, it wasn't just you, and you're taking all the credit. So the relationship ruptured.
Yeah, and that's when he went to, or he left Ford Motor, and eventually went to Chrysler. I just wanted to say one thing before we take a break and then talk about the Chrysler episode. I think it is interesting when you look back at the 20th century that McNamara, who became President Kennedy's Secretary of Defense in 1961, was, as you say, one of the whiz kids in Ford Motor in the late 50s, that we actually remember him more for Vietnam than anything else. If you say Robert McNamara's name and Google his name, most of it is Vietnam. That he was associated with that war in Vietnam and, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis, too. But primarily, and I just thought that was interesting because when he became secretary, when he accepted President Kennedy's offer to be Secretary of Defense, here's a man who came from the car business, had no experience whatsoever in defense or military, and now he's the Secretary of Defense. It didn't really
work
out, Frank.
But in military, he did, and logistics. And after the
break,
you're right about that.
Yeah, you're right about that.
If you want, do the break, and
I'll take the break and come back, because I find McNamara to be a really interesting character in the story, but not the principal topic tonight, but nevertheless a principal story. So let's take a break. We're going to take a little break here, and we'll be back with our friend Frank right after this.
Carlos Guerrero Harpies. I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Sisiki's at the Star, located at 6765 Winning Drive in Frisco. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy music at 6:30 until 9:30 p.m. Make your reservation today at 972-377-2276. Remember, Sisiki's at the Star is the place to hang out on Saturday night. For upcoming dates, look for me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we have a friend, we have a link to our friend Carlos Guedes on the show information. Click on that, and it'll take you to his schedule here in the Dallas area. Let's get back to our friend Frank Burke. We're talking about Lee Iacocca. That's our main topic tonight. But we got off a little bit on McNamara, and I made a mistake. I said he had no defense experience, but you're right. He did in logistics, Frank. So go ahead and finish that, please.
Okay. David Halberstam, who was a very good historian, tragically killed in a car accident, did a book years ago called The Best and the Brightest. And basically it asked the question, okay, Kennedy and Johnson picked the best and the brightest people they could, and they mired us down in Vietnam. How did that happen? Well, a part of the story was republished, I think, by The Atlantic under the title The Programming of Robert McNamara. And they talked about McNamara's career at Ford as he matured after the war and computer technology came in. He would go into a meeting and he'd sit at the head of the table and all the guys would have, you remember the old big computer printouts, and he'd say, okay, where are sales in the Midwest? And one guy would go to his brother, they'll hear, okay, what do we have to do to get those sales up? And another guy would come up and say, well, our competitors have been out-advertising us by a factor of 3-1. Okay, a decision is made. Let's go to more advertising. I mean, one way or the other, he's getting all this information from the staff, and he's compressing it in his mind and making good decisions, okay? So fast forward to Vietnam. And let's go to a small village in Vietnam, and the helicopter touches down, and McNamara and his aides get off. And they go to the head of the village, and they say to him, okay, where are the Viet Cong? And the guy says, well, they're here, here, and here. How many are there? Well, there are so many. What do you need to destroy them? Well, I need this, this, and this. Okay, you've got it. Guys, make sure he gets what he needs. And they take off. The only problem was, the Vietnamese guy was full of crap. He didn't tell him one word of truth. But in that culture, it was you had to answer a question. You could not say, I don't know. So McNamara is proceeding as if these people in the field are giving him, very primitive people in some cases, not their fault, but that's what it was, are giving him the right information regarding the deployment and assignment of troops, and they're not.
Interesting. That's, I guess maybe that was the beginning of garbage in, garbage out.
Yes, it was. That's for sure.
Okay. No, but I just think in so many ways, McNamara, professionally, I don't know anything about his personal life, but professionally, was kind of, you know, his life didn't turn out the way I guess he really wanted it to turn out. Because I'm sure when he became Secretary of Defense, the last thing he thought that he would be remembered for was Vietnam, and much of it, of course, with Lyndon Johnson, not with John Kennedy, because by the time Kennedy was assassinated, the war was not what it became. Whether it would have become that way under Kennedy, that's the big question that we will never know, but it became under Johnson. And whenever I think of McNamara, I think of how frustrating it must have been for this man of industry who was accustomed, like you say, to make quick decisions and solve problems, to all of a sudden be mired in this Vietnam War that he really had no idea how to end, Frank.
Yes. In fact, before he died, I have not read it, mm-hmm. but he wrote a book, which was a very profound and tragic apology.
Mm-hmm.
He took responsibility for a lot of what had happened in Vietnam, and he was clearly very much haunted by it. And, you know, it's
yes.
easy to say, okay, he was there, he was making the decisions, but I think you have to put it in the context of what was going on. And certainly, the way it all turned out was not quite his fault.
No, of course not.
He was in over his head. We all were. Yeah.
No, of course not. He was carrying out. Now, I suppose he could have resigned, you know, in 65 and 66 and said, I don't believe this. I'm out. But he didn't. For whatever reason, he didn't. And that's, that's another topic, McNamara. Let's get back to Lee Iacocca now. He's out of Ford Motor Company, and he's now, in a sense, looking for a job. He ends up with Chrysler. And then he finds out pretty soon that the company is about to go under in the late 70s, Frank. Take it
right.
from there.
Well, Chrysler was suffering badly, and he went to the government in something that was really, how can I say, unique. It had not happened up to that time, and asked for a government bailout of Chrysler. And a lot of people were against it. Well, no, we can't bail you out. We'd have to bail everybody out. But the reality was there were some other factors involved. One was the fact that the United States government had given carte blanche to a lot of foreign importers, especially the Japanese, who were undercutting, dumping in some cases, and undercutting American automakers. Secondly, they put a lot of restrictions. It was the start of all the regulation on everything from miles per gallon to pollution and whatever that was costing our guys an awful lot in terms of money and wages and everything else. And technology, there was a tremendous investment that had to go into it. So they were guilty in that way. But there's something else that a lot of people don't realize, and that's the fact that Chrysler, like all of the big three, like Ford and GM, Chrysler was involved in some very, very heavy defense contracts. I mean, who else is going to build the defense establishment of the United States but your leading industries? So it would have been very, very foolish. They would have been cutting their own throat on many, many programs, including, I believe, the Abrams tank. I may be wrong about that, but I think Chrysler was involved in that to let Chrysler go down the tubes. So the government came through, and as I mentioned, the advertising, Iacocca, there was some residual value in some confidence in him as the man who made the Mustang. He was the head of the greatest success in U.S. automotive industry since the Model T. So if anybody can do it, Lee Iacocca can. Plus, he had this incredible personality, this charisma that showed through on the commercials where he made the promise himself. And, you know, one of the things Leo Kelmanson said to him, quoting a very old saying that's very true, people do not buy from companies, they buy from people. So, and the American public loves an underdog who's turning around, who's coming back up to bat, and this time he's going to hit it out of the ballpark. So that was the scene. And
yeah.
As they got into it, you know, Chrysler made a lot of changes. They literally streamlined a lot of operations. They came up with some interesting technologies. And they were among the first, not that it was successful, but everybody thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of cars with it to have the digital dashboard and the ever annoying, you must fasten your seatbelt, you know, the voices
right.
in the car, or you are low on fuel, and you couldn't shut it off.
Right,
so,
yeah.
People thought that was, you know, well, at the time, what the heck. But he did that, and, of course, he wrote books. He wrote Talking Straight
mm-hmm.
and communicated well with people. And in 1976, if you remember, for the bicentennial, he was the one who led the campaign to restore the Statue of Liberty and the
yes.
buildings at Ellis Island. So he did a lot of the right things. He gave a lot, you know, in terms of public service. My wife and I, some years ago, this is parenthetical, restored an 1879 vintage schoolhouse,
mm-hmm.
Which is right near our farm. And on the wall, we have one wall that has pictures of all of our friends and some of our relatives, I'm proud to say, who were teachers. And in the middle of it is a framed quote from Lee Iacocca, in which he said, in a rational world, the best of us would be teachers. The
mm-hmm.
rest would have to settle for something less.
Isn't
that beautiful?
That is very profound, to say the least. Now, one of the things that I remember of this time period, we're talking about when he got the, it was during the Carter administration, as I recall, that
mm-hmm.
he got the loan guarantee. And he went to the Carter administration and said, look, I have this idea to rebuild Chrysler. And he did. He rebuilt it. He paid back the loan, you remember. But two
yes,
things that
absolutely.
Really stood out in my mind during that period. Number one is he succeeded. He didn't just say, bail out the company. No, he said, give me a loan, and we're going to make this company better. And it really became a top-notch company after that loan guarantee. So in that sense, he didn't just bail out the company. He made it better, which is, I suppose, the way it should be. The other thing that I remember about Lee during all that time, he became the face of the company.
Yes.
You know, most of the other companies would advertise their cars. You know, they would hire, I crack up to think, you know, Ricardo Montalban, you know, of
yeah.
Fantasy Island. He was doing a commercial for the Ford or the Mercury Cougar, you know. And
right.
they would always have, of course, some beautiful blonde, you know, doing one of the
singing.
Yes,
either
that's
USA
right.
and your Chevrolet.
Yeah, that's it. Or they have some beautiful couple, you know, out to dinner in their Buick Park Avenue or Fifth
right.
Avenue, whatever. And I mean, those were great ads. I mean, I have to say they're fantastic ads. I enjoy watching them on YouTube from time to time. But Chrysler's ads were always Lee. And he was talking about his employees. If you notice, a lot of the ads, he was at the factory saying, this is the best car in the world. We make it. These guys make it. I thought that was really cool that he decided to advertise that way, Frank. I don't know if he came up with that idea, but whoever did, that was brilliant, Frank.
Well, it was. And I think that a lot of that was probably his friend Leo Kelmanson. But the thing about it, too, that to remember is the fact that Chrysler was noted. If there was one mark that Chrysler had as a company, you know, in Detroit, Chrysler was noted for advanced engineering. In all of their cars, right up to the time that they even flopped, the engineering was more advanced. They introduced more features that everybody else eventually had, because that was the way it was. Walter Chrysler was an engineer, and you know, the that was an orientation of the company.
Interesting. What about? Yeah. Go ahead, Frank. Go ahead.
I have to tell you a personal Chrysler story. Can I take a moment?
Please, please do.
Okay, I was working at Sunstrand.
I'll tell you one of mine too, but.
Okay. I was working at Sunstrand Machine Tool Company, and this is in the 80s. And Chrysler, everybody was trying to adhere to the mileage standards that the government had put out and their lack of wisdom. And Chrysler's, one of the answers was to have an engine that when you went, it ran at a kind of reasonable level, but when you accelerated, an impeller pushed air, literally supercharged, pushed air into the combustion chamber and gave you the extra power you needed, okay? So they were trying to figure out how to mass produce the impeller. And when I say an impeller, think about what an aircraft engine looks like with the multiple curved blades coming out of a central point. And that's what you would they wanted to use as a supercharger. So they were in a lot, and they were working with our applications people, and we got to know some of the engineers. So one day I kind of got a little bit bold, and I said I was the advertising and marketing manager, and I said to this one engineer from Chrysler, I said, "Is this going to work? I mean, what's going to happen?" And he said, "Well, Frank, what do you mean? Is it going to achieve mileage?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yes, it'll do that." And I said, "Well, okay, what's the second part?" He said, "Okay, what's the object of more mileage? It's saving energy. Now, consider all the energy inputs that go into a car. The metal has to be mined. You have to have it cast into the engine block and the parts and forged and machined. You have to have the upholstery come in. You have to have the paint. You have to have the chrome. You think of all of those, the energy inputs that go into one single car." He said, "Now, this is going to achieve the mileage. But in order to do that, a four-cylinder engine is going to run very, very hot. And the life of that car will be lucky if it makes 100,000 miles. So tell me, who's saving energy?"
Exactly. No, you're right. You're exactly right. My story is a good friend of mine from India in the late 70s asked me one day to go with him. He was shopping for a car. And I said, "Of course, I'll go." So he was down to two cars, a Mercury Monarch. Remember the Monarch, which was Ford. Was a Ford? I think it was the Ford Granada, Mercury Monarch.
Uh-huh.
I think that's who it was. It was a very nice car. This is, of course, late 1970s American cars, and
right,
not the same as the cars that came in the 80s that were much better. This was not a good time for Detroit, as you know. So we went to see the Mercury Monarch, and we drove it, and I said, "Well, this is really a nice ride. I like this one." And then we went to see whatever the Chrysler counterpart was to it. This is, again, before Ayakaka took over, or at least started revolutionizing the company. I thought, you know, the Chrysler product was so inferior to the Ford product at that point that I felt sorry for the salesman at the Chrysler dealer. Because I said, "My God," I didn't tell him this, but I said to my friend, "This is such an inferior product. You can all you have to do is ride in this car, and you see what an inferior product it is." And then he ended up getting the Monarch, which I don't blame him. I would have done the same thing. But
sure.
In my mind that day, I realized just how, you know, how much work Lee Iacocca had to do to turn
absolutely.
That company around.
Absolutely.
Because he had to really change the mindset of those workers from being basically just coming in and punching the clock to now producing a high-technology car. Now, another controversy that I remember, Frank, was many people saying, no, we shouldn't give Chrysler a loan guarantee. Let it go under. I guess that's, you know, the more traditional free market approach.
Well,
I don't know if, in retrospect, you know, maybe that, and in retrospect, maybe it was right to give him the loan guarantee because he saved a lot of jobs, but he made it a better company, Frank.
Well, he saved jobs. He saved the defense aspects of it. He made it a better company, and the competition had unfair advantages. You know, it's like every time I hear these idiots, pardon the expression, talk about the Paris Accords, okay, and climate change. And the U.S., first of all, how much man-made pollution is responsible for climate change, I don't know. If a couple of good volcanoes will do much more than we could ever do as people. But the bottom line is they would put tremendous restrictions on the U.S., which is responsible for maybe 2% of gas emissions, and they leave China and India alone.
Right.
Meaning
that
our guys would be crippled,
right,
and they would have tremendous advantages and be spewing all this crap into the atmosphere.
Absolutely. And that was my opposition to the Accords, too.
Well, and when you go back to Chrysler, at that time, they're under pressure from the Japanese, who have Miti, the trading company, that are underwriting their companies, their car companies, exporting their unemployment. Hey, it's
mm-hmm.
cheaper for you to sell at a loss, and we make it up, than it is for us to pay welfare to your employees. That's
right.
What it was all about.
Yes, and I just remember that time period. It was very controversial, that whole thing. But just, again, about the Paris Climate Change Accords, I had two problems with it. Number one, it was not a treaty. It should have been approved by the Senate
yep.
as a treaty, and it was not. President Obama never submitted it as a treaty because I think he knew he would never get even Democrats to vote for it. So that was my first problem. It was constitutional. But the second problem was that even today, a lot of the countries who signed it are not even living up to it. The other day
I
saw
a
story of a bunch of the countries that were critical of Trump for pulling out. They're not living up to it. So, I mean, here's the other thing, too. What is the point of having an agreement that you cannot enforce?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, okay, so I lease you my apartment, but I cannot evict you?
Yeah,
that's,
exactly.
Yeah, what kind of an agreement is that? But anyway, that's climate change and the Paris Climate Change Accords, which is not our topic, but nevertheless, I understand your point about unfair advantage. One more thing that I wanted to say about Mr. Iacocca. And it looks like in the latter stages of his life, I think he got out of the car business in the early 90s, mid-90s, and he did start or tried to manufacture an electric car, but it didn't go anywhere, Frank. Maybe he was too premature. How much do you know about that?
That I know nothing about that.
Yeah, I just read that in his obituary. I was not familiar at all with that until I read the obituary. And I didn't know anything about it either. That
no.
he had tried to start an electric company, but you know, I don't know how much energy he had, physical energy, personal energy to take on another project. You know,
yeah.
At that time of his life when he was almost in his 80s, but he was also premature because even today electric cars are still in the infancy.
I was
talking to and that's today. I mean. 10 years after Lee Iacocca tried it. So anyway, but I think overall, Frank, I think this was a consequential man. And this he was not perfect by any means. Nobody is. But I think this is the kind of man that they'll be reading about in business schools for many years, Frank.
I agree with you, Silvio. I agree.
Yeah. I think this is the kind of guy that when people are looking at, you know, business leaders and business and management styles and how this man did that and that man did
that. Oh, yeah, it'll be a great case history.
That's it. And his book is also, I would recommend the book to everybody. I thought it was interesting. One last thought about the book. In the 1980s, late 80s, early 90s, it seemed that every sales call I made, Frank, there was a copy of his book on the person's desk that I was calling.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, definitely.
Do you agree with that? I mean, because
yeah,
it was like everywhere I could bet my life and said, I could bet my life and say, yeah, I could bet my life and say, the next guy I call on is going to have a copy of his book. And I was right almost 100% of the time.
Yep.
And then to top it off, Frank, guess what book my dad gave me for Christmas during that time?
Lee Iacocca's book.
That's it. You know, I cracked up when I saw, I said, you know, my dad said, this is a good book, you ought to read it. And I said, okay, well, I'm glad you bought it because I was going to get me a copy because everybody I talked to mentions the book. What do you remember about the book? I thought it was
very little.
Not
Lee. Lee.
I don't think it was really a business book. It was more of a story book.
Oh, of course. I must apologize, but I'm going to have to run. So
okay.
I can't thank you enough for the show. It's been a great time.
No problem, Frank. No problem at all. And thank you again for your time as always. Thank you so much. Oh,
thank you and God bless to you and our audience.
Same to you. No problem. Same to you. All right, well, that's our friend Frank Burke up in Wisconsin as we look back at the life and times of a really consequential man, Lee Iacocca, just one of those guys that comes around and, you know, he leaves his imprint, as they like to say, and I think that it was, to say the least, an extremely, extremely important one. And again, read his book. If you haven't, read his book. I guess you can get the book now on all kinds of Kindle and audio or whatever, all these different ways. But I would recommend that you pick it up sometime and read it. It's actually a very enjoyable book. Not really a business book, but it tells a lot of great business stories. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you the next time.